Hey everyone, this is Quinn from Drug Topics. We are here with Austin and Grant Brown today. If you two want to introduce yourselves a little bit, we can get going on the interview.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Grant Brown. I am a pharmacist, graduated in 1980 with a BS and in 1983 with a PharmD from the University of Michigan. And have worked in community practice my entire career, along with long-term care, some industry consulting, as well as working for in the infusion business as well. And very pleased to be here today with everyone.
Hi, everybody. My name is Austin Brown, and I am the vice president of the Advanced Care Provider Network here in Jackson, Michigan, working alongside my father, Grant, help oversee the operations of our pharmacy sites, as well as a durable medical equipment practice and an audiology practice, so a little bit multidisciplinary. Graduated from the University of Michigan College of Pharmacy in 2017 and have been practicing in the community space ever since then, and looking forward to talking with everybody.
Great. Well, we're super happy to have you guys here today. To kick off, so of course there's a big gap in years between when you two both did your education. How is the pharmacy landscape as a whole different, Austin, in your first years versus Grant when you started out?
Oh, I mean, now with the PharmD degree, that's the standard of practice in terms of how pharmacists come out of their training. So for me, that was, that was pretty much just what was to be expected of me. Now, when Grant was in school, the PharmD was a newer degree, and it was an extension of that registered pharmacist and the additional training that comes along with that, focusing on the other clinical aspects of how pharmacists can help provide care in the overall healthcare system. So I think in terms of, what we've, the differences there is, when Grant was doing that, coming out of school with that PharmD degree, a clinical pharmacist and some of the opportunities that and the expertise that they could bring to the table was newer and not as well known. So he was really blazing the trails for getting other healthcare providers to understand how pharmacists are going to participate in that care continuum. And then versus when I got out of school, that was kind of the expectation. And then the ability to practice on that level and on a clinical aspect of what opportunities are available as a pharmacist are much more wide scope now. So probably the biggest difference in from what I can see. What do you think?
Yeah, well, some of the things that go along with community practice haven't changed. There's always a threat. Back in the early 80s was the beginning of, the PBMs and then mail order programs. Clearly back in that day and time, PBMs were a transactional based partner in pharmacy practice to enhance and improve reimbursement models. And then, the mail orders became the first threat in the late 80s as that model started to impact the reimbursement in the community pharmacy setting, as well as retail and chain. Nothing's changed since then. What we continue to do is focus on opportunities to better serve patients, look at clinical opportunities to enhance outcomes, and what those things were being done in the 80s and 90s kind of blaze the trails for the pharmacists today that are in the community setting, from a recognition of the value of the clinical practice. But now we have additional changes and threats that we continue to work every day to try and offset the financial implications of providing services in community practice.
Awesome. So I definitely want to touch on, you mentioned the PBMs in a little bit, but I want to start off, Austin, you talked about how the clinical training has become more of the standard today. How has having that more clinical training really helped you help drive the change you need in your operations on a specific level?
That's a great question. So it's augmented the ability for a community pharmacist to practice and look at other aspects of the patient's care. So I think it's important to recognize that as pharmacists, relinquishing the idea of dispensing prescriptions, I think it's really important that pharmacists always control that part of the process. There's a lot of ways that you can, nowadays with the technologies, you can streamline those processes and make it so it's not as much of a the main focus of your practice. But I also would argue that that is still an important aspect, and we have to be careful to never relinquish that. But from a clinical training aspect, utilizing the skills that pharmacists are trained with now, it accents and complements the dispensing process. So if you can create the capacity through your dispensing process to also add in clinical services, and it can be as simple as checking blood pressures and checking on, you know, blood sugar levels. Are you taking your statins as appropriate? And just doing a review of the medication regimen for making sure it's optimized. That's really where we can start. So it's not so much just dispensing the prescription and hoping that the provider, checked all the boxes in terms of looking at, is the medication optimized and appropriate? But the pharmacist has become an extension of that process, and then identifying when a correction can be made or adjusted, and then communicating that back with the rest of the healthcare team. Pharmacists now are thinking a little bit on a higher level in terms of practicing that way than just making sure that the prescription is correct, safe, and accurate. So it augments those practices.
Well, and to the point of having opportunity to work with a lot of graduates over the years, including Austin and his wife, Erica, and a number of the employees that we brought on board over time, that clinical practice that and training that they receive today helps them, you know, take care of the complex patient issues that are presented in the pharmacy every day. The complexity of personalized medicine, high cost meds that are included in patient regimens that may or may not be dispensed from the pharmacy, but are still part of the overall treatment plan for a patient, become an important component of how you effectively counsel patients and be able to offer them a complete service and support. You know, one of the biggest challenges we continue to face is transitions in care from when complex patients are moving from one setting to another. And that clinical training and understanding what's happening inside the four walls of one institution versus the community setting are an important component of really supporting those patients as they present at the pharmacy.
Switching gears a little bit to go touch on the PBMs you guys talked about. What are some of the strategies you've helped implement in a time when PBMs are increasingly decimating reimbursements? And do you think those measures have done enough or are doing enough?
You know, it's the topic of this time, and the strategies that are done at a local level are also being employed at a state and national level. The responsibility of the business owner is to recognize what those threats are from the standpoint of changes in reimbursement, DIR fees, and how that's impacting cash flow, and recognizing the ways that not only the state and national associations are trying to impact DIR fees and PBM impact on practice. You have to be able to, you know, recognize the patients on a one-by-one basis, and not only a one-by-one basis, but the family and what the value of that family is, and how you can identify ways to continue to take care of them based on, you know, the overall cost. We still, you know, take for granted that we're going to fill prescriptions and be able to take care of the patient. We're going to get reimbursed and remain profitable. Now, because of the way the contracts are in place, some drugs are, you know, totally, the reimbursement is not adequate to continue to take care of them. So that patient, you know, often is transitioned to the PBM provider simply because of the cash flow implications that go along with that. That's a hard thing for people to swallow. I mean, that's not in our genetics. We're there to help people. And you know, so that's a threat that's real, and it's being talked about at every level of pharmacy right now.
In terms of identifying that, it's all about, you know, just like everything else right now, data is king, right? Pharmacy practice, especially community practice, is no different. So, you know, granted, we took for granted that, you know, you could fill the prescription and that was what you paid attention to. So the level of detail at a very granular level, claim by claim, is really now a requirement of identifying how you're going to effectively shift your business model and what strategies you're going to create to remain profitable and keep the lights on and take care of patients. So, you know, our partners at American Pharmacy have provided really good tools through some other market partners in the technology and the software space, where that data is coming through in excruciating detail. And so then the challenge for pharmacy owners now is identifying the most important pieces of data based on the claim. Is that claim profitable and good for my business? Is it appropriate for the patient? And when a hard discussion about whether or not a patient is going to be able to continue to use the pharmacy, you have to have good concrete numbers to demonstrate why or why not. So there's another level of not just taking care of the patient from a healthcare outcomes. Now you're looking at the healthcare of your business in terms of, you know, is the continuation of taking care of this patient going to lead to a spot where the lights turn off? Which is, to Grant's point, something we really, really wish we never had to take into consideration. We got into the business because we're the most accessible member of the healthcare team, and somebody can come in and see us and ask us that question. So the idea about having a discussion to say, I can't do what you need me to do, is a tough pill to swallow, no pun intended, but it's hard. And it's a discussion that a lot of pharmacies are having and trying to come up with other ways to figure out what happens next. And that starts with knowing your data, knowing your numbers, and having real time analysis of that information.
I get an opportunity to speak to a lot of pharmacists across the country, and many of them are thought leaders, but on an everyday basis, I'm still surprised sometimes what number of pharmacists and owners don't know their own numbers. They don't know what their percent of DIR fees are by plan. They're not projecting what's going to be happening in the next, 12 months between now and this time next year after the, changes in the reimbursement patterns and as of January 2024. And, the intensity of that education is now ramping up greatly, because it impacts the entire pharmacy model up and down, from the pharmacy practitioner at the community level to the wholesalers to the payers. Access to care is an important consideration for PBMs. And if they don't have pharmacies in a network, because there's no pharmacies in those communities, they have issues with regards to how they can present themselves for contracts. So the term pharmacy desert is a reality these days. It happened the first time around in the urban markets, and now it's happening quite significantly in rural markets. And these are the harsh realities of where we are, but we continue to fight the fight. Everybody's trying to do the right thing right now.
You guys mentioned American pharmacies. So there's really only so much you can do, of course, as individual pharmacies to battle all the challenges you mentioned. Why is it important to be part of a group like American Pharmacies in a time like this?
Strength in numbers is number one. I mean, I'm a advisor to the board of directors and been a shareholder within American Pharmacies since 2018. Previous to that, I've been involved in other buying groups and GPOs over the course of our career and our operations and closed door pharmacy operations and long-term care pharmacy operations and infusion. And so the buying groups and the GPOs are really an important component because of the ability to maximize still the recovery of additional dollars against the cost of goods. You know, you can call them rebates, you can call them other things too, but bottom line is that's what's happening. And as a result of great operations, you know, American Pharmacy is significantly impacted, a reduction in our cost of goods, even though, you know, we've seen continue to see like generic deflation, reducing those opportunities there. And, you know, they've done a great job. They offer an array of support services to help pharmacies better manage their operations and improve their bottom line. And, you know, they've got a technology platform that many of the pharmacies take advantage of that helps them identify key performance indicators in regards to, you know, operations on a regular basis. So they've made a big difference in our operations for sure.
They're definitely an extension of our voice. Again, strength in numbers, as Grant mentioned. You know, not only what they can do from us on a you know, cost of goods standpoint and a drug purchasing standpoint, but also their efforts within legislative advocacy. They've been incredibly helpful with that. And there's been examples around the country where bills that help strengthen the independent pharmacy model have been passed at state levels. And a lot of times there's an American Pharmacy shareholder or a member that's had a hand in how that bill was crafted, how it was explained, and how it became to be successful. So having a group like that in your corner that can extend that voice and extend what all the pharmacies individually are struggling with and bring a collective effort, not just from the pain points that we discussed, but also, as mentioned, through the technologies and the data, being able to help us tell that story. You can do that. You can only do that so much when it's one pharmacy. But when you've got hundreds of pharmacies across multiple practice sites in multiple states, and you're starting to see a pattern and you're able to tell a story, on a larger stage, American Pharmacies has helped us extend that message significantly. And that's been a real pleasure to help them be successful with that.
Yeah, sticking on that, you touched on the legal aspect a little bit at the end there. Why is it important, and how important is it that independent pharmacies let their elected leaders know kind of what is happening?
Yeah, huge. If you know, every elected official I've ever come in contact with prides themselves on being a grassroots person coming from a small town, having ties to those communities. And so if I hear that, and they want good health care, everybody wants access to health care, everybody wants those things. And so, you know, it is so important to be able to tell that story, because we're grassroots, we're from small towns, we like taking care of people. You just told me all those things are very important to you. Here are the threats that I face every day that are looking looking very hard to make sure that I don't have a seat at that table. So in a time where bringing it back to a small town feel, bringing it back to the individual is becoming increasingly important and recognized as things continue to you know, vertically integrate and become held, you know, the power is held by a select group of individuals. This is a time where, from a legislative standpoint, there's opportunity to be very impactful in shaping the healthcare landscape for the United States.
Well, and to that point, the fact that over the last 3 or 4 years, the pharmacy community has come together to try and right the ship. And from the standpoint of the impact of reimbursement models that currently exist and who is driving those threats. And the national and state legislative actions have been significant. Getting as I have been involved with state and national communications with legislators, their awareness today is higher than ever regarding recognizing the threats. And so, you know, the actions that are occurring at the Federal Trade Commission at this point in time, the actions that are occurring in legislative actions, you know, on a national basis with bills that have been introduced in the last couple of years, and those that are at the state level are really important. And you know, picking up the phone and sometimes maybe it's not talking directly to the legislator themselves, but to their staff and the key aides that are within their offices. Those are really important links to being successful in helping members of the legislature understand and vote appropriately to help us fight this fight. The thing about having somebody visit your pharmacy or you visit their office, it goes both ways. And every time that occurs, there's always another level of understanding that maybe wasn't there before. So we're really at a critical point to help, sustain pharmacy practice on a long-term basis. And you know, everybody should reach out. You know, they appreciate it. You know, it's been said a million times, you know, used to be you wrote a letter. If a topic got three or four letters in a legislator's office, then that made a difference. That three or four letters heightened the awareness more so than anything that hadn't been done previous to that. So in today's world, reaching out and pointing out exactly where pharmacy needs help is really critical.
Yeah, change can't be made unless, you know, we know what the change is, what change has to be made. Yeah,
exactly. They can't fix something if they don't know what the problem is.
So. Right. So speaking of the future, you guys, how do you see the future of independent pharmacy? What do you think the future looks like for independent pharmacies over the next couple of years?
They're going to see a lot of entrepreneurial spirit. You're going to see a lot of innovation, and you're going to see a lot of different practice models that are going to show up. Pharmacies are going to they're going to shift from a place where that's where I go to get my prescription into a wellness destination. That's more than just the prescription. It's I got the prescription, but I also got all these other things that go along with my overall health and well-being that are beyond what's just in the bottle. And that's pharmacists, that's nurses and nurse practitioners, it's different types of clinical services, it's getting out from behind the counter and needing to go out in your communities and do that. There's going to be a lot of interesting ways that people are going to go about doing that. And the exciting part is it doesn't have to be standardized necessarily. If there's a need, independent pharmacy owners are really, really well positioned to adapt quickly to the need of the community. So, depending on what is needed where they're at, that pharmacy is going to try to figure out a solution for that. So that's where the prescription process always has to be ours, but streamlining that and working on strategies such as medication synchronization and adherence packaging and some of those other things that enhance the service of getting a prescription are going to become increasingly important. They're already increasingly important, and those types of activities that streamline that process create the capacity to go out and get out from behind the counter and do the rest of what needs to be done. And then the next piece of that is identifying appropriate ways to get properly reimbursed for the services provided. That's definitely the way forward. And I'm really, we've been fortunate to dabble in lots of different spaces like that. Our immunization programs are very robust in terms of the breadth of immunizations that we offer and how we do them. You know, you don't have to come and see me in the pharmacy. I will come to you. I will provide a clinic. I will educate the public. That's become huge, and especially over the course of the pandemic, the entire country saw how pharmacists can really go out there and make a difference in that respect. There will be different types of health and wellness clinics that are run by pharmacists and their peers. There will be different types of preventative medicine, such as diabetes prevention services and self-management education. There will be other augmented clinical services like hormone replacement therapies and travel clinic, destinations internationally. functional medicine, nutraceuticals. I mean, take your pick, the opportunity of what a pharmacist can bring to the table and then take it and run with it based on what they see the market needs. It's going to be awesome. I can't wait to see what happens. Because there's going to be things that people are going to go, I didn't even think about that. Let's get into that. So it'll be really exciting to see what pharmacy as a profession comes up with based on just some of the really innovative people that we've got, especially in the independent space.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the other thing is that the revenue model is going to continue to change. You know, clearly how we've been reimbursed for the prescription medications continues to change, but the opportunity on things that Austin talked about, whether that's nutraceuticals or other over-the-counter product supplements, you know, people are, especially in the demographic probably from 35 to 50, are really looking at ways to enhance their own health. They're learning so much more today about options and how treatment is approached. It's not, you know, 30 years ago we had, you know, we had basically allopathic medicine and a path that pharmacists and the medical community worked on together. If there was a innovative practice, there might be somebody that was offering homeopathic options to those patients that were seeking alternatives. Today, it's not just one or two channels of opportunity or where people seek care. And so the challenge for the pharmacist, quite frankly, is understand what's going on and how those things either are going to make a difference in a person's life, or, you know, how they might be able to offer services that hadn't been provided before, services and products that can, you know, provide a livelihood for them themselves.
You guys talked a little bit about, you know, all these patient-centered clinical services and the expansion of pharmacy. In your opinion, do you think these are profitable enough to really be able to implement on a larger scale? And if not, what do you think, what changes do you think should occur to allow that to happen?
No, that's a great question. You want to go with that one?
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been trying to work within the pharmacy community my entire career to create reimbursement models for clinical services that would support clinical activity in a number of different settings. And thankfully, and we've seen the recognition of clinical services provided by pharmacists and the reimbursement that goes along with that in a multitude of settings. Community pharmacy is still the most challenging. If you're in a health system, or in an ambulatory care setting, pharmacists get paid enough to support that salary. In the community setting, we're still struggling to, you know, have that be an impactful amount on a larger scale. So it's work to continue to be done. The reality is that you're really trying to provide clinical services that augment your distribution and primary core business, and that helps bring more patients in. And depending on the service, you might find things that will pay for a salary, but to be independent, it's a bigger challenge. I mean, I think back to people like Dan Buffington out of Florida, who created a clinical services model that had been recognized for the better part of almost 25, 30 years. And, you know, well-respected individual, how he approached that was then scaled by a number of different practitioners across the country. And as those models continue to evolve today, awareness is a really important component of how the more practices that implement those services and then seek reimbursement, the higher the likelihood is that we'll continue to see success in getting paid for what we do.
It's definitely a back to strength in numbers. You know, more pharmacies are recognizing that this is what needs to be done. And there's groups that have come from that have come together and created, you know, there's the accountable care organizations, and now we have to come up with the accountable pharmacy organizations. And you want to get paid, you got to have skin in the game too. And you got to hit the metrics and you got to meet those numbers and the demands of what's required. And groups like CPESN, the Community Pharmacy Enhanced Services Network, I'm a luminary for the state of Michigan for that group. And in what I have learned from those pharmacists that have been very innovative with how to successfully do that has been incredibly eye-opening. And it turns up, provider status is of course, one way to get over that hurdle. And I won't, we beat that one to death, so I won't go into that too much. But that's one of the big walls that stands there for a lot of pharmacists who don't know how to navigate the payer system as well in order to start providing these services, because you have to understand the different languages of what's going on the prescription drug side versus what's going on the medical side. And so the groups like CPSN, who have had successes in contracting on national and state levels and helping pharmacies and pharmacists figure out the best ways to do that, has been really, really insightful. So it's, do we want to get paid more? I mean, yeah, who doesn't? But it's, to coin the phrase from, some of the leaders that I've worked with in CPSN, it's, are we trying to get paid more, or do we want to get paid differently? And so it's really emphasizing the differently, and then showing the value proposition of why a pharmacist should and can do those things. And then setting up, contracts with different payer groups, and showing that, you can standardize that across the board, but depending on the level that you want to get involved with it and what you really want to accomplish as a business owner, that's very malleable. You can make that what you want it to be based on the payer or the provider that you want to work with. So again, that comes back to, the really innovative things that people have seen. So is it enough to get us where we need to go right now? I think a lot of people would argue, no, it's not. But is the potential for it to be more than what it is so far based on the success stories that we've seen? Absolutely. You can build a model out of that. You can scale that. That proof of concept exists. And we just need to show as a profession how we can leverage that opportunity to continue to grow it and then show that to the larger payer groups and CMS and et cetera.
All right. Well, I think that's a great spot to leave off. Austin Grant, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to come talk to us today. You guys were fantastic. We really appreciate you coming on.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. We look forward to, continuing to work with all of our colleagues to make a difference as the profession continues to change.
Yeah. Thank you for having us. Thank you for giving us a voice. Look forward to talking again in the future.